Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 66 of NML Crossing, where, if my math is right, and it hardly ever is, but just in case it is, this may be the official halfway point of this program. Really depends on how many episodes we go, obviously, but I want to say it's either going to be 133 or 134 episodes, depending on some Nightwing mileage, which may vary here. There, in all the roadmaps, there's a Nightwing Secret Files and Origins that is lumped in with No Man's Land, but I flipped through it a few times. I haven't read it yet, but I have flipped through it a few times, and it doesn't look like it's... really doesn't look like there's much of anything noteworthy. I could be completely wrong, but in any event here, we are rapidly approaching, or we are at, the halfway point of NML Crossing, and, well, as a man of milestones, it's, seems semi-monumental, I suppose, but, who knows. Anyway, today, not much of a pre-ramble, because we got a lot of story to discuss. A lot of stories, as a matter of fact, because we are back in anthology land. This is Batman Chronicles number 16, which had a spring 1999 cover date. All of these stories are edited by... you know, there's no editors listed. I had to go into the Indicia to find the editors here, so who knows? The ones in the Indicia are Vincenzo, Gorfinkel, Illidge, Carlin, and O'Neill. Cover price for this oversized issue is $2.95. We got three stories, and we probably ought jump right in. We're going to start off with our main event of the evening here. This is a story called Two Down, written by Greg Rucka. Pencils by Jason Pearson, inks Cam Smith, colors Digital Chameleon, letters Rick Parker. And this is a tale on the road to No Man's Land, and it's actually one that's going to pay off a dangler from, a story we discussed very, very early on during Cataclysm. It's one that confused me because it made me think I missed something, and in fact, we all missed something because that story hadn't been written yet, or hadn't been published yet. It is a Rene Montoya story, and it takes place post-Quake, but pre-No Man's Land. It opens outside the GCPD HQ, where Commissioner Gordon is demanding that Rene take some time off. She and the entire GCPD have been working tirelessly and without any breaks since the Quake. He tells her to take 48 hours off, and, well, if he sees her doing any copping in that time, he's going to send the National Guard to, open fire on her. Which, you know, a bit extreme, but his heart is in the right place. Now, Bullock, he tells her not to take it personal, because he was just told the very same thing. We're not going to follow him. Maybe in Batman Chronicles 17 we'll find out where Harvey went. I don't know. Anyway, we follow Renee back to her old neighborhood, and to the Montoya grocery that her parents own and operate. Upon arrival, she finds local no-goodnik Miguelito attempting to bully her father into giving him more than his fair share of the rations and threatening to hurt her father if he doesn't. Well, Renee pops in and cocks her pistol right at Miggy's head. He backs down, which is probably the smart play, and the entire store erupts into applause, which is like something out of a Reddit post or something, isn't it? Anyway, later on, Papa Montoya kinda reads Renee the riot act about waving her gun around, and, well, she admits that it's actually empty. She ran out of bullets days ago. Now, Dad complains about the cops and FEMA abandoning their neighborhood, and Renee kinda just lets him air his grievances while reminding him that, well, Gotham is a pretty big city, and, everybody can't be everywhere all at once. Mama Montoya enters the scene to inform Renee that her brother Benny has gone missing. Don't worry, this isn't the same, a-hole Benny from that Azrael issue. This is the Benny from the Rucka text story that we covered some time ago. I want to say that was in another issue of Chronicles. And this story is basically the prequel to that story. If you remember that story, we had a lot of questions about what happened, how we got there, and a certain supervillain getting involved and having his life saved, so maybe we'll see that play out here. Anyway, Renee is pretty shocked to hear that Benny was even home in the first place. She figured he was going to be overseas somewhere. Mom says that, he went out to help out in the neighborhood, and he hasn't been seen since. Optimistic dad suggests that they probably won't ever see him again. And with that, Renee runs off to find her hermano. And it doesn't take her long. It's the very next panel, anyway. I guess it could have been a few weeks between them, I suppose. Though there's really nothing to suggest that there was. Anyway, she finds Benny, who is running with a new gang of folks trying to help and protect the neighborhood. And one of those gang members just so happens to be Harvey Dent. Now, Renee instinctively pulls her empty gun and points it at Two-Face's faces. And, well, Harvey is quick to inform her that they're all on the same side. They're all friends here. Also, he knows that the gun's empty, so he really isn't all that scared. Worth noting, he's wearing kind of a take on, well, I guess it wouldn't be a take on something that hadn't happened yet, but if you remember the Death of the Family story that happened, like, within the first year, maybe the second year of the New 52, where the Joker had, like, that Joe's Garage mechanic outfit. Here we have Two-Face wearing something very, very similar, except it's Jose instead of Joe. Which doesn't mean anything, but it's still, you know, for people like me who try to notice symbolism even where it ain't, I was a little tickled by it. Anyway, Benny tells his sis that Dent has been nothing but a help of late, and he insists that Renee and Harvey shake hands, which they do. During which, Renee thinks to herself how soft Harvey's hands are, which I guess when you see one side of him, you might think that he's going to be really, really gross to touch. Now, we follow the rescuers as they, well, rescue people who were buried in the post-quake rubble. We see Dent hacking away at some debris with a mattock until he hears a survivor cry out to him. And so, before he proceeds any further, he... Any guesses what he does? Well, of course, he flips his coin to see if he's fated to assist this poor unfortunate. Thankfully for them, it comes up scar side down. Renee looks absolutely flabbergasted by this entire exchange. Some hours later, the team of do-gooders manage to save all of the trapped children there. Later on, Harvey and Renee, and it's weird having Harvey and Renee in my script here and it not being that other Harvey. I don't know. Harvey and Renee, they're on another search and rescue mission at a rapidly disintegrating apartment building. After trudging their way in and hearing a cry for help, Two-Face flips his coin and demands that Renee shine her flashlight at it so he can see what he's supposed to do. Once again, it's scar side down, so they proceed with the rescue. And so, they start digging their way through the walls. Unfortunately, these just happen to be some of them load-bearing walls, so no sooner is the Gothamite rescued than the roof starts crashing down. Harvey and the civilian, they're able to avoid getting clobbered. Poor Renee, however, was in ground zero of the cave-in. Harvey approaches her, flips his coin, and only then proceeds to dig her out. Sometime later, Renee wakes up at her parents' place. Two-Face brought her there to rest and recover. After Renee gets her wits back about her, she suits up and gets ready to head back into the neighborhood. Her father pulls her aside to give her something at this point, and it is a single bullet, which he spent all of his money to buy in order for her to protect herself. This is perfect, she thinks, because she is still very worried about working alongside Harvey Dent. And she wonders what might happen when the coin doesn't go the way it needs to go. You know, she wonders what she might have to do when that inevitability comes to pass, because it ain't always going to come up scar side down, right? From here, we jump to a double-page spread of montage of Harvey and Renee flipping coins and doing good deeds throughout the neighborhood. Each time the coin comes out, Renee instinctively reaches for her gun, just in case. One night, perhaps even the same night, we see Batman watching some of the cleanup from afar. Some no-goodniks approach Two-Face about joining up with them, you know, once bad, always bad, right? And so, he flips his coin. And I suppose we can guess that it landed scar side up because Harvey proceeds to beat the hell out of these Blackgate geeks. Renee joins in the skirmish, and it's here where we see one of the baddies about to kill Harvey with an axe. And it's also here where Renee shoots the guy, saving Harvey's life in the process. If you remember that from the text story, right? I sure remember it. I remember an axe-wielding maniac that Renee had to shoot. And here it is playing out right before our very eyes. Anyway, before the dust can even settle, Batman swoops in to knock old Harvey on his butt. As he lay on the ground, he goes to flip his coin to see what his response to this ought to be. Only, as he flips it, Renee catches the coin before it can land. Now, Harvey starts really freaking out here. He really needs to know what the coin says. At this point, Batman goes to apprehend Dent, but Renee is able to talk him out of it. She assures him that she can reach Harvey. And, well, maybe uncharacteristically, he allows her to give it a try. But he also warns that he will be keeping an eye on both of them. After he swoops away, Renee tells Harvey that she'll be holding onto his coin for the foreseeable future. Now, to this point, I forget what I do with anthology stories. Like, do we talk about them as they happen, or do we just get them all, you know, synopsized and then talk about all of them? Or I don't remember. I've done a bunch of anthologies in my time, and I'm sure I've done it both ways. Here, though, I kind of want to talk about this story on its own, because it is the strongest story of this issue. The other stories we're going to get to aren't bad at all. They're both good stories, but this one, definitely top of the pile here, and I'm glad that it was the lead-off story for the issue, because I would assume that it's the one that got most read, right? You usually read from the front to the back, so even if you get winded or tired, you're going to get through this one probably, and it's a good one. It really is. It makes me wonder, like, we read those, recently we read those trio of one-offs, right? There was an issue of Detective, an issue of Legends, and an issue of Shadow, I believe, where I commented probably too many times that these felt like they should have been anthology stories. And here we are with almost the complete opposite. Because I do know that Harvey and Renee's relationship, or whatever we're going to call it, becomes a pretty big part of the, you know, second half of this crossover event. And it's weird to me that this story appears in the anthology rather than getting its own issue. I feel like this could have carried its own issue. And maybe I'm only saying that because it was, 16 pages? I don't even know how many pages it was. It might have been the size of an entire issue, for all I know. But it was good. It was really good here. I think I often forget the fragility of Harvey Dent, where without the coin, he is directionless. He is hopeless. He is lost. It's really got control over him rather than him just using it as a, you know, as a gimmick. It's legit. He doesn't know how to act. He doesn't know how to respond. So I feel like this is going to be very interesting moving forward, where he's not going to have the coin to refer to when faced with a decision. And, you know, I know that these are good stories. That's all I really remember about them. I don't remember what happens in them. It's been a quarter century. But I do remember enjoying them. So I'm looking forward to re-experiencing them here on this show, and hopefully enjoying them just as much. It is a little weird that we had the text story to start this arc, and then we go back in time to fill in the blanks to get to that text story. It's an odd way of telling the story, but a good one. And it's weird because after reading that text story, I don't know if I mentioned this on the air. It's been a while, but I actually started digging through my long boxes to see if, like, I missed a story where Renee saved Harvey from being, you know, chopped up to bits by an axe-wielding maniac. I pulled out a bunch of issues of Detective. I pulled out a bunch of issues of Batman, and came up empty. And now I know why. But anyway, this was a really good story. The art was good. It just didn't really fit the tone. It was very cartoonish. It was probably the most cartoonish I've ever seen Two-Face. And I mean, that includes Two-Face's appearances in the cartoon. Very odd decision to use such a cartoony but talented artist on this sort of story. It really didn't fit the tone for me. But still really good. Still highly, highly recommended. Now, our next story, we start to get silly. This is a story called The Comforts of Home, written by Scott Beatty with pencils by Damian Scott, inks Wayne Foucher, colors Ian Lachlan, and letters Clem Robbins. And it's here we open with a pair of no man's landers scaling the side of the Wasteloff Knives and Cutlery building. Now, it's a dude named Jeff and a gal named Melanie, and they appear to be a couple, probably married, because there is a joke about an annulment later on, so I'm guessing they're married. We also see a bat-eared observer in the foreground watching the scene play out. Now, this bat-eared observer thinks to themselves that these two goofballs are, well, they're goofballs. Melanie says they shouldn't even still be in the city, to which Jeff says they had to make sure his mom got out in time. Thing if it was, she was already long gone, leaving these two stranded in no man's land. Anyway, atop the building, they decide to break into the building, and as they do so, it'd be clear to anybody except these two who had recently been living and or operating out of this place. We see smiley faces, we see clown paraphernalia, we see all sorts of silly, silly stuff. Also, Audrey 2 from Little Shop is here for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe there is a... I'm not even going to play coy here. This is the Joker's hideout, or one of the Joker's hideouts here. It's very obvious. And I wonder if he had a man-eating plant at some point. He probably did. I don't know. If you know, let me know. I'd love to check that out. Anyway, they're inside. Mel finds a framed photo of the Joker next to his Joker-mobile. And neither of these numbskulls know who this is. I mean, it's a clown. He's basically wearing the Killing Joke outfit, you know, like the Hawaiian shirt and everything. And they just say, hey, it's some guy with a funny car. They blow a layer of dust off the table, which illustrates to us that this place has been long, long abandoned. And so they continue on. They enter a room with dried blood all over the floor and a good dozen busted up bat signals, and, well, they're still not getting it. Also, they're hungry, so they're gonna raid whoever used to live here's fridge. Remember, like three panels ago, there was like literal caked dust on all the furniture. I don't know about you, but I don't think I'd be eating anything out of this guy's kitchen. It's a moot point regardless, because all that's in the fridge are donor organs, a can of Coke, and a box of baking soda, because you gotta keep things smelling fresh, right? They continue searching for grub, and they do come across some. They got jars of peanut butter and clam juice. Maybe the Joker was pregnant. I probably shouldn't have even put that out into the atmosphere. If the Joker winds up knocked up anytime soon, I will take full responsibility, and as penance, I will jump off the nearest roof. Mel then enters the next room and flips on a television, and it looks like the Joker only has one channel, and it's tuned into, I don't know, the Marion Dora channel? It's slaughterhouse footage, in case you didn't get that reference. A phone rings nearby, which startles both of our interlopers. They don't dare answer it, and at this point, Mel's getting real squirrely about being there. Jeff, on the other hand, seems to be kind of enjoying this little adventure, and he suggests that they press on. And so they do. Mel takes a step into the next room and falls through a trap door in the floor, and the down below is flooded. It's all water. And it's full of belly-up Jokerfish and a skeleton wearing a Batman costume. Was that from the Many Deaths of Batman? That John Byrne thing from late 80s, turn of the 90s era? Don't remember. I seem to remember a skeleton in a Batman suit underwater. Maybe I might be conflating or dreaming things up. Who knows? Anyway, Jeff pulls her out of the drink, and then they find themselves in the bathroom, stood before a funhouse mirror so Mel can dry herself off. In the next room, there's a display featuring a skeleton wearing a Robin costume. Under it's a plaque that reads, "The Day I Won." There's also a framed Jokerfish named Clarence, and what appears to be the original The Scream by Edvard Munch, or Munch. I don't know how to say names, you guys know that. They assume that whoever was living here must have been... the Joker? or someone just as demented? Nah, they figure it's just some eccentric artist. Anyway, the phone rings again, and again they don't answer it. They continue into the next room, which has a small sign posted on the door, which reads, Hostages. Inside are, well, a whole grip of corpses. And it's here where Jeff finally decides that it might just be time to skidoo. But the phone rings again. This time they do go to answer it, but they are thankfully blocked off by a batarang. And it was thrown by Batgirl, who is now here, and she's here to ensure that these idiots don't do anything stupid. Well, stupider, I suppose. Anyway, she tells them to beat it before rigging up a bat line to yoink the receiver off the hook. Once she does, the entire place goes boom. After the dust settles, Batgirl instructs this couple of fools to where to go in order to, be safe. Neither of them can believe they were just at the Joker's hideaway. I guess they finally realized it when Batgirl told them. Oy. What's more, Jeff didn't leave the place empty-handed. He actually swiped that can of Coke out of the fridge. Any guesses what's about to happen? Any? Well, he hands it to Melanie, who takes a sip, and the doy immediately starts laughing. We wrap up with our gal totally Jokerized. Wonk, wonk, wonk. And you know, I think I've complained about every Joker story we've had so far in No Man's Land, but this one was more like it. I mean, he didn't show up, but he loomed large, of course, and it was silly, it was funny, and I mean, I had my fun with it, talking about how oblivious these two goofballs were, not knowing where they were, but I had a lot of fun with it. Like, it leaned into the silliness just enough to where, I don't know, we could kind of get into the obliviousness of these two, and, like, we know what's going on, of course. That's, we're the observers outside, so we know everything that's going down. We know all the secrets. And it was kind of neat seeing just two random Gothamites, no man's landers, happening upon, one of the worst places you could possibly be in an already horrible place. It also gave a little bit of a shine to Batgirl here, saving the day and just watching these two. Like in that first panel where they're climbing up the side of the building and about to break in, we pan out and we see Batgirl there and she just says, idiots. And it's great. It's great because everything they did from that point on was so idiotic. And the ending was a little bit contrived. I mean, I feel like anybody who's read any Joker stories could have seen that one coming a mile away, and I know I did, but you really can't get mad at it for being what it was going to be, right? So yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. It didn't overstay its welcome. It had enough room to breathe, but not enough room to suck all the air out of the room. It was a good story. It was a good story. Had a lot of fun with it. Let's hop into our final story here, which is the weakest of the three. It's also the shortest of the three. And it was also written by Denny O'Neill. The story's called Harold, again, written by Denny O'Neill, with pencils by Chris Renaud, who is the fellow who gets all the credit for, or a lot of the credit, for inspiring the Cataclysm in the first place. So we talked about that in the New York Magazine article that we covered ages and ages ago. Inks, Sal Buscema. Colors, Ian Lachlan. I did it again. Letters, Clem Robbins. I see his name starts with a C and I want to instinctively say colors, but letters, Clem Robbins. Now, we open during the very bad thing that happened at 703 with our pal Harold in the Batcave. And we see him about to be overcome with debris and whatnot falling down upon him. As this happens, he enters into flashback land, recalling his last, I guess we can say, conversation that he had with his mother, wherein she basically just screams at him to get out of her sight and to never, ever come back. Harold winds up buried in Batcave bits, and he wakes up some time later. He surveys the place and sees the damage the quake has wrought, and he instinctively reaches for his tool bag, knowing that he has a lot of work to do, which is great for him because when he works, he is happy. As he tinkers away on a busted-up Batmobile, Alfred approaches, and he tells Harry not to worry about fixing things up, which our hero doesn't quite comprehend. And so Alfie sends him away. He tells him to leave until he calls for him, which flashes Harold back to that last traumatic confrontation he had with his mother. With tears in his eyes, Harold leaves Wayne Manor and walks into post-quake Gotham City, and what he sees is a very, very broken place. You may say it's a place very much in need of repair, which is a good thing, since when he's working, he's happy. And that's it. It was a little, you know, a little pick-me-up. A little short one there for old Harold, but I feel like it doesn't quite fit, because I don't remember Harold being sent away. He was actually working on the Batcave. He was working on Wayne Manor. I mean, he showed up quite a few times during Cataclysm and Aftershock, right? So I don't know where this story supposedly happened. Did like Alfred send him away and then 5 minutes later call him back? I really don't know. I really don't know, but it wasn't the worst thing in the world. It wasn't an issue of Azrael, I'll tell you that much. But it still feels like it just doesn't quite fit. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe my timetables are mixed up. Who knows? But definitely the weakest link in this anthology, but still not horrible, which I suppose is... Maybe is all we can hope for with a story like this. Overall, these three stories, wasn't mad at any of them. The first one was really, really good. The second one was fun and silly. The third one kind of just ate up a few pages, but it wasn't anything offensive. Certainly worth a peek if you find it on the cheap. But I think that's all I got to say about the issue itself. How about we hop into the mailbag before we cut out of here? We're going to start with our friend Chris Yu. And we're talking about Azrael, of course. We just finished up 2 days in Azrael land. So let's discuss it. Chris says, and this is about the Jellybean Death Trap Joker issue. So, the first major appearance of the Joker in No Man's Land is in a book that doesn't matter to the overall story. This had to be another attempt to boost sales on Azrael. The thing I was most surprised by was the lack of continuity in the appearance of the Joker's henchmen. Totally different design for the henchmen here as compared to the henchmen who accompanied him at Sarge's house. And that was in one of the one-and-dones. I think that was the Shadow of the Bat issue. And Chris is totally right here. The henchmen there looked more like kind of like Tweedledee Tweedledum-ish, you know? They were like... Oompa Loompa-y. They were weird. This guy was just like some buff dude in clown paint. So, definite lack of continuity there. And it's Azrael. I mean, what's that? I never seen Chinatown, but I know there's like a famous line like, oh, what do you expect? It's Chinatown. What do you expect? It's Azrael, right? It's kind of just a... I think that's how we're going to have to take things with Azrael. Chris continues. Seeing Azrael be confused as to who he is, either Azrael or Jean-Paul, and then being asked if he was Batman was comical to me. He's not sure who he is, but at least he knows he isn't Batman. And that's very true, and it's also very funny, because every issue of Azrael so far, he has asked himself that question. Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Am I Azrael? Am I Jean-Paul Valley? Am I whoever? The only thing that's for sure... is that he isn't Batman. That's just great. I don't know why that made me laugh so much, but God, you could ask him if he's the mailman. He'll say, yeah, I don't know, maybe. But he knows he's not Batman. And I was thinking more about that scene where that woman approached him and asked if he was Batman, despite being Azrael, being not Batman. It makes me wonder if this woman was so out to lunch that she was, like, just asking anybody if they were Batman. It's like, hey, you, digging through the dumpster, are you Batman? Because I got a message for you. Hey, you, Commissioner Gordon, are you Batman? Because I got a message for you. Just insanity. Back to Chris. He says, these Azrael issues feel like they were written to take place alongside the main story, but not interact with the main story. I think you're dead on. I almost feel like after the whole storyline was plotted out during the Bat Summit of writers, artists, and editors, Denny then went home and said to himself, God, I'm picturing this. Denny went home and said to himself, now how can I shoehorn Asriel into the story without changing the story? Which is, I mean, it had to be, right? It had to be that way. Chris continues, this feels like it was written years later as a, and this is what Asriel was doing during No Man's Land. Just like the 1999 Legends of the DC Universe Crisis on Infinite Earth special, which was meant to tie into the original Crisis on Infinite Earth storyline. And you know, I remember that one getting a lot of press on Usenet, and I think even in Wizard, that Crisis one. That was one I wasn't even like fully invested in DC at that point, but I ran out and I bought that one because I thought it was going to be important. I tried reading it and made no sense to me. So I went out and I bought Crisis on Infinite Earths, the trade collection, which, you know, I knew what it was intended to do. Of course, I knew what the story was supposed to accomplish, but that didn't make it any easier to read. And Chris is right. This feels, it feels like it was written later, but also like it was written 20 years earlier. It's just so bizarre that Asriel is even involved in the first place. I think we talked the other day about the novelization that has no Asriel in it. No Nick Scratch in it. I need to actually go find that thing. I've seen it and I've left it behind so many times at various bookstores and wherever, whatever place I have happened across it. Like, I think I've seen it in Goodwill. And I never bought it. But I think I'm gonna have to. Maybe I could just grab it on Amazon or something. I'm sure it's only a few bucks. But I think I do want to compare what we get there to what we get in the comics here. I wonder if Rucker wrote that based off of, you know, the what came out of the Bat Summit. You know, before Denny went home and said to himself, self, how can I make this about Asriel? Very interesting stuff. Very funny stuff, too, when you stop and think about it. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. But thank you so much for writing in, Chris, and making me laugh here by picturing Denny O'Neill at his word processor trying to find clever ways to interject Asriel into this story without affecting the story in the slightest. Next up, our good friend Eric here talking about Asriel. And he says, the Asriel story was as you described it in the podcast. It was weird that Asriel could jump a four-story building, including the mother shooting a gun at her daughter to get frustration out, and also that the building was right next to the dock. Even the fight on the docks with the homeless guys was awkward. It definitely felt rushed toward the end. I still don't understand what Nick Scratch is up to in Gotham. He got what he wanted by having it become a no man's land. Yes, it's so true. It is just utter insanity, and it's so wildly convenient, but it's also so wildly pointless. I really don't know what Nick Scratch is up to. You know, I did a little bit of research on Scratch the character when we first encountered him back during the road to No Man's Land. I'm like, yeah, who is this guy? Does he have a new 52 counterpart? You know, did he get a rebirth special? He actually doesn't make it out of the Asriel series. Asriel issue 100, the final issue, is the last appearance of Nicholas J. Scratch. And so I really wonder what the point of him is here. Of course, Asriel is not included in any of the abridged trades that I read. So these are all new to me. You know, 100% new. Characters like Nick Scratch are also 100% new to me. So I don't know what his goals are. I don't know if it'll even be picked up on fully. You know, these issues are, and don't get me wrong, I'm having a lot of fun talking about the Asriel issues. So I don't want it to come across as like something that I'm dreading, like legitimately dreading. I can joke around and be like, oh, we gotta do Asriel. Because at the end of the day, it's silliness and it's fun. And sometimes you need, a little bit of the, you know, you need the Brussels sprout on your plate to kind of make everything come together. But I really don't know what Scratch's goals could be here. Like, does he have an end game, or is he just, I can see just like that cliche chaotic villain. You know, he is the chaos to Asriel's lesser chaos. I really don't know, but I'd be lying if I said I wasn't looking forward to finding out if it ever gets addressed. So we will continue and see where it goes. But utter insanity, these Asriel issues. But boy, I'm having a good time with them, so there's that. Eric continues. In regards to the topic of moving to different places to live, I've moved a couple of times in my life, and I can understand the sadness of leaving a place that was once called home. In my early 20s, I left the home that I lived up to that point in my life, and it was very sad to leave. But I also had the opposite in some moving situations. In those, I was not sad to go. It was like I just needed to get out of that place. And those reasons varied from not liking the property management company of an apartment complex to just not wanting to live with family and to have more freedom. And, you know, moving is different for everybody, right? And it could be different for, as Eric puts it here, it could be different for the same person. You know, you have times where you're excited or where you really just want to get out of a certain place. And there's other times where you may still have excitement and a desire to leave, but there's also, you know, it's bittersweet. There's a sadness that comes along with it because, you know, it's not like you're, and I don't want to get too esoteric or precious, but like, there is a difference between a house and a home, of course, right? Any place can be a house, but few can be home. And I think when you find places that you consider a home, and if you're anything like me and you become like embedded in them, because that's what I do, I embed where I live, that makes the leaving all that much more difficult. And I'm also very ritualistic. Like I think I mentioned the other day, like closing doors behind me, knowing that that's the last time I'm going to see the inside of that room or the last time I'm going to be inside a particular room. I keep score that way, and it's not healthy. It's not ideal. It's not good for mental health. It's not good for anything. It really is just, I don't know, maybe it's an attempt at poignancy. Maybe it's an attempt at forcing something to be a little bit more important than it ought be. I really don't know. But, you know, I love hearing stories about how people cope with changes in life, whether it be just different phases or different places or different faces, you know, anything like that. I get a lot out of hearing those kind of stories because that is something that I struggle with pretty consistently. You know, change isn't easy for most people, but for me, it is, you know, I need the double-headed coin with the scar on one side because I just get lost. Changes really, really get to me. Just moving from this house to the other, my dishwasher's on the other side of the sink. And I mean, that just messed me up. I'm like reaching one way and it's like, oh wait, the dishwasher's on the other side. And like, it actually paralyzes me for a moment. And granted, I am far more precious than most people. But, It got me. It definitely got me. And it just really drives home the power of change and the power of place, I guess. And unfortunately, for someone like me, that is something that lingers long after it should. So who knows? But again, Eric, thank you so much for writing in about Asriel, of course, and about your life and times. I think that's one of the things. I don't think I'd ever call this show special in any sort of quantifiable sort of way. But if I were, I would say that these personal stories that we all share and the oxygen that we all share here in this little comic book clubhouse we've built together is something that makes this show special. You know, it certainly is to me, and hopefully it is to you all as well. But that is the mailbag for today, and of course, if you'd like to join the conversation, I encourage and invite you to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, all the socials as well. There's also the Bada Bin Show on YouTube you can check out. I'm pretty sure we're going to be putting an episode this Wednesday, but I can assure you it'll be one day this week. So I'll share that link when it happens. And if you're there when we're doing it live, feel free to pop in and say hello and chat us up about anything you want to chat us up about. I think that could be a good deal of fun. But I think that's where we'll wrap things up for today. I'd like to thank you all so much for sharing a little bit of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight. Starting over after it breaks. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You better turn that page. When push it comes to shove, we do not fall out of love. We dove.